Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the rise and fall of Grooveshark. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I crashed you.
You did.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Let's just get on with it. This week's episode of Setlist is the second of 20 special editions marking the 20th anniversary of CMU that we will be putting out over the next year. In these episodes, we'll be looking back at the 20 biggest stories we've covered over CMU's first two decades. We kicked off a few weeks ago with a look at the last days of EMI.
Yeah, you need to collect all of these, all 20. Yeah. It's like a Panini sticker album.
Yeah. This week, we're going to look at another thing coming to an end. In fact, we're going to look at the entire short-lived history of the streaming service Grooveshark. It wasn't around for as long as EMI, but coincidentally, it does fit into pretty much exactly the same time period as the EMI episode.
The final chapter.
So that's nice. We'll have to rewrite all of these so they only cover that period of time now, maybe. No, let's not. I guess we should go back to the start, the very beginning, and remind listeners what Grooveshark even was.
Yeah, so for most of the time that we were reporting on and writing about Grooveshark, it was a streaming service.
Yes.
Of a similar mould to Spotify, although a lot of people knew it because it worked really well through the browser, whereas obviously a lot of the other streaming services, to get the proper experience, you had to download their app. So that is certainly what Grooveshark came to be, although like quite a lot of digital music companies, it had various other iterations in the early days. So I think at one point it was trying to monetize P2P file sharing.
Yeah.
A lot of people had a go at that, trying to...
Yeah, it was a weird model. Basically, it was a P2P file sharing service like any other, except that rather than just freely sharing tracks, users bought and sold them. So if you uploaded your MP3 collection, you sold the tracks for 99 cents, another user bought them, 70 cents of that went to the label that owned the music, 4 cents went to Grooveshark, and then you, the sharer, earned 25 cents for some reason, an incentive for selling music, I guess.
Yeah, so it was one of various attempts in the mid-2000s to take the P2P file sharing phenomenon that was occurring. So they launched in, 2007, you said?
Yeah.
So by that point, where was the file sharing fad? We were onto LimeWire, probably, by that point. So Napster was long gone, Grokster long gone, Kazaa had disappeared into a virus-filled frenzy. Everyone stopped using Kazaa, and people were using LimeWire, and various people, including one of the Napster founders, were trying to set up this thing and say, okay, P2P file sharing is really popular. Can we find a way where the record industry would embrace this? The labels and the artists can make a bit of money, but the fans will still want to use it. The answer to that question was no.
Well, also, one of the benefits of being an unlicensed P2P file sharing service where everyone could share things freely is that there are no barriers to sharing anything. But if you're going to set up a monetized service where people can share things, albeit selling them, but share their entire MP3 collection, you have to have licenses with every single rights holder and be able to identify the music in each track so that you can make that exchange and divide up the money between the correct people. And while some indie labels did sign up to that service, quite unsurprisingly, the majors were not on board.
And iTunes was starting to take off by this point, and so as far as the major labels concerned, the only acceptable download model was the iTunes model. So yeah, very quickly, really, that original licensed legal P2P idea was put aside, and Grooveshark became this streaming service. But I suppose the big difference between Grooveshark and, say, Spotify and Deezer, who were both starting to emerge around about this time, we're sort of in the late 2000s now, was that Grooveshark allowed their users to upload their music collections into the system, and that then created the catalogue that then streamed. And I suppose in some ways, Grooveshark were trying to take what they'd attempted with P2P file sharing and apply it to streaming, which is we'll get the users to create the network, and then we'll go to the music industry and say, okay, we've got this great network, it's now streaming rather than downloads. Hey, music industry, do licensing deals with us and allow us to make this network legal. You can make some money, we'll make some money, and all of our users will be happy, and we will be the big streaming success story, I think, was the idea around that plan.
So they had an ad-funded tier and a premium tier, and it was basically pretty much like any streaming service you would see now, except it had a vastly bigger catalogue because it was users uploading all the content. They didn't have to wait for the labels to do licensing deals and pump the content in and decide which content to pump in, because it was all there. There was pre-release content because You know, it's fair game. Anything could go up there. The labels, unsurprisingly, were not happy about that. Although it was a weird early point in streaming where people were kind of willing to see what stuck and let different models go forward. So they did actually, they got a few kind of, like with their previous service, they got a few little deals, but they did fairly quickly get sued by EMI. Good old EMI, come back again.
Yeah, they still existed at the time. As you say, Grootok had been going a while with this streaming iteration before the litigation arrived. It was the early days of streaming, remember. Spotify and Deezer were starting to gain some traction, but mainly in Europe, because it took quite a long time for those two services to get to the US. Meanwhile, in America, when people talked about streaming there, they were generally talking about Pandora, which obviously had a very different model. And so then this Grooveshot thing arrived. And I suppose in some ways, there were also parallels between what Grooveshot were doing at that time and what YouTube was doing. Although YouTube was not a specific audio music service, fans were uploading large amounts of music into the YouTube platform. Although the labels had by that point started to do their early deals with YouTube. SoundCloud subsequently, having been very much pitched as a service for producers and music makers, became a place where fans were uploading their content. So they certainly weren't the only user upload platform which had lots of unlicensed content swimming around. And so initially, some labels were like, maybe there is something here. Streaming probably is the future. Is this an interesting model? But in the main, the majors didn't like Grooveshot, hence the EMI litigation.
And also it being kind of these early days of streaming where it hadn't become the industry that it is now. It wasn't perhaps as professional as streaming is now. Grooveshot sort of made its first misstep at this stage.
Yeah, so Grooveshot was run by a few guys in their early 20s. They were based in Florida. I remember meeting one of the founders at a conference in Dubai around about this time when it was very early days. They'd launched a streaming service. They were in the midst of the first EMI litigation. In fact, I think they may have already settled it just by that point, but it was very early days for Grooveshot. And they were, well, they were quite, what's the word I'm looking for?
Cocky.
They were very cocky. and to an extent, they seemed almost a little bit like the original founders of the Pirate Bay. Though I'm not suggesting that their ambitions were quite so focused on illegal distribution of music like the Pirate Bay were. But they did often say things which seemed to be deliberately designed to wind up the record companies. And one of the things that this founder told me at this conference back in Dubai, so I assume it's true, was when the EMI litigation came in, because that was sort of the first big legal challenge that they had. They were just this little company based in Florida. Obviously, the big music companies are in New York and Nashville and LA. They weren't even in Miami, which is the one place in Florida where there is a local music industry. So they didn't really know what to do when litigation arrived. But a friend of one of their families or something, they knew a lawyer. But the lawyer wasn't an entertainment lawyer. He wasn't an intellectual property lawyer. He was just like some local lawyer based in their town in Florida, who I think mainly did like family law and divorces and things like that. And so they went to him and said, we've been sued by EMI. Will you contact EMI? So they then phoned up EMI to say, okay, we're representing Grooveshot. Can we talk about this? And of course, the hotshot entertainment lawyers back in New York were really pissed off that this small town lawyer was being sent in to negotiate this massive copyright infringement
they
lawsuit.
They took it as a slight rather than just naivety.
So yeah, what are you doing sending this guy in? All of that said, despite the fact that by this point, all of the majors were expressing concerns about the way Grooveshot was evolving, the way it was getting its content, the fact that it was getting quite a big audience, they did settle that EMI litigation. They were not a rich, billion-dollar backed startup, so it's not that they wrote massive checks that some other people in similar situations have done, but they did manage to settle the EMI lawsuit and out of that get an initial license from the EMI record company as was then existing.
Yeah, it did briefly look like they might become the YouTube of audio, as they kind of liked to style themselves. But a few months later, in January 2010, Universal's lawyers came knocking and Grooveshot was sued for not having a license or paying any royalties for the Universal recordings on its system. And this litigation also specifically criticised the lack of a content blocking system, which would stop tracks from being re-uploaded to Grooveshot's servers after takedown notices had been sent, which is something that YouTube did have in place by that point.
Yes, so by this point, the wider conversation around user upload platforms was evolving, and we, for the first time, were starting to write about the bloody safe harbour, which has subsequently dominated so many CME dailies and editions of Setlist ever since. Even though the safe harbour was inserted into copyright law in the US in the late 1990s and elsewhere in the early 2000s, so it wasn't a new concept. But it was around about the end of the 2000s, around about 2010, 2011, that the safe harbor started to come up into conversation. And Grooveshark was part of that conversation. Because as I've already alluded to, Grooveshark sort of sat between the Spotify's and the Deezer's over here. It was an audio streaming service with a free version, pay for version, etc., etc. But it also sat alongside the YouTubes and the SoundClouds over here because it was ultimately a user upload platform. And what the major record companies were saying was, well, hang on a second, it looks like you're a Spotify and a Deezer and you're offering that service, but unlike Spotify and Deezer, you haven't done any deals with any record companies, you haven't got licenses, you haven't paid us our advances, you're infringing copyright. But then Grooveshark would say, oh, no, 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 we're not a Spotify and a Deezer. We're like YouTube and SoundCloud and all of those sorts of sites over there. We're a user upload platform. And what that means is, under this thing called Safe Harbor in copyright law, I assume by this point they had got some IP lawyers working for them, or maybe the family lawyer in Florida read up on all of this. But what they started to say was the very common defense that we've subsequently heard from all sorts of user upload platforms, including YouTube, which is, aha, it's our users who are uploading content into our servers. We're not doing that. We're a user upload platform, which means you could go and sue the individual users who uploaded the content. But how are you going to find out who those are? Who's got the time to bother? But you can't sue us because our users are uploading it and we are protected by this thing called Safe Harbor. And then the music industry would say, OK, we don't like that. But what we do know is, in order to have Safe Harbor protection, you have to have a takedown system. There has to be a process in place where we can come to you and say, you don't have permission to use our content, remove the content. And if you don't remove the content, then the Safe Harbor falls and we will sue you for copyright infringement and you don't have a decent takedown system. Look at YouTube over here, because we're now in the period, around about 2011, 2012, when, let's not forget, the music industry was liking YouTube.
Yeah.
So if we think
it's
about
hard to imagine
with YouTube, there was a period of YouTube being this sort of new service, everyone uploading music. We don't like YouTube. YouTube says, haha, Safe Harbor. So, oh, we don't like Safe Harbor. And then the majors all did their licensing deals with YouTube. They got a little bit of money when YouTube was subsequently acquired by Google. And we were in the period when the labels were earning their advertising share from YouTube. And they were using it as an upsell platform to sell downloads on iTunes. And YouTube was seen as being the responsible Safe Harbor dwelling platform. And so they would say, well, look what YouTube's doing. They're developing this thing called Content ID so that we can more easily manage our music on there. So if you want Safe Harbor protection, you should do that too. Your takedown system is really rubbish. It's just a case of us sending documentation in and then you saying at some point you'll deal with that documentation. That's not a good takedown system. So we think if you want to have Safe Harbor protection, you should be following YouTube's lead. And of course, some people in the music industry were going as far as saying, not only is your takedown system rubbish, we suspect it's deliberate. Deliberately rubbish.
Yes.
Because it's in your interest for all of our music to be on your platform. So maybe the allegation was you've got a deliberately shoddy takedown system, which means that by the time you've processed our takedown claims, several thousand of your users have re-uploaded our content into the platform, rendering the takedown system useless. And therefore, that's a very sneaky use of this safe harbour.
That said, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is not really very clear about how good your takedown system should be. It only says that you should have one. So your takedown system, no matter how shoddy, it probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, the DMCA was annoyingly vague about what it meant by a takedown system. And in some of the early cases testing the safe harbor within the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and testing how good the takedown system had to be, including some litigation pursued by Viacom and MTV against YouTube, and then Universal Music also sued an early YouTube competitor called Vio that was then ultimately sued out of business on this. But in those early cases testing what does this takedown system have to look like in order to get safe harbor protection, the judges didn't set the bar very high. They seemed to be accepting pretty rubbish takedown systems as being compliant with the law. Subsequent precedent in some key American cases have started to set the bar a little bit higher. But at this point, it felt like actually Grooveshark's shoddy takedown system probably would satisfy a judge, which means the safe harbor defense probably would be sufficient. Which meant that when Universal Music decided that it wanted to sue Grooveshark, it was presented with a challenge, which was, if this goes to court, Grooveshark are going to show up in the courtroom and they're going to say, we have safe harbor protection. Okay, our takedown system's not very good, but the law doesn't say it has to be very good. And Grooveshark might win. And the last thing Universal Music wanted to do was to have this big, high-profile, landmark legal battle with Grooveshark and go to court and lose and have a precedent set that Grooveshark's model works and anyone else could pursue that sort of streaming service.
So therefore, Universal, in its first lawsuit, and something that featured in various other lawsuits subsequently, relied on technicalities relating to catalogue released prior to 1972. Because there are weird technicalities in US copyright law between what's covered by state and federal law.
Yeah, this was the first time I came across America's pre-1972 copyright quirk. And so for me, this particular litigation was a learning curve, because I can remember when the lawsuit came in from Universal, who'd been threatening to sue GooShot for a while, and all of the tracks listed in the lawsuit were from the 1960s. And it was like, well, why are they picking tracks from the 1960s? What's going on here? And then you dig a bit further and it's like, oh, in America, there is copyright law at a state level and there is copyright law at a federal, US-wide level. And when it comes to the sound recording copyright, for reasons of history, anything released since 1972 gets federal level copyright protection. Anything released prior to 1972 isn't protected by federal copyright law. Instead, it is protected by state level copyright law. This then subsequently became a really big issue, because under federal US-wide copyright law, services like Pandora and the satellite radio company Sirius are obliged to pay royalties to record companies and recording artists. And they started saying, but federal copyright law only applies to records released since 1972, so we don't have to pay those royalties on pre-1972 catalogue. And so as a result of that, what we've seen, and indeed the Music Modernization Act that is going through Congress as we speak is attempting to address this, is trying to get those principles of federal copyright law applied to all sound recordings that are in copyright in America, rather than just those released since 1972. But in this scenario, the music industry wanted it the other way around, where they were trying to exploit this pre-1972 quirk to their advantage by saying, ah, but the safe harbour, which you claim gives you protection, and we suspect if it went to court, probably would give you protection, but that comes from federal copyright law. So therefore, can't apply to sound recordings from pre-1972. So screw you, we're going to sue you specifically for the 1960s recordings that are on your system, because we don't think with those recordings you'll have the safe harbour protection you need.
Yeah, but actually, the pre-1972 argument faltered at the first instance and GrooveShark won in court, although the ruling was later overturned on appeal.
Yeah, the judges, when hearing that argument, sort of fairly asked the question, hang on a second, if we're saying that there's this big safe harbour designed to protect tech companies, but then we're saying it doesn't apply to pre-1972 recordings, what we are basically saying to the entire tech industry is, you now need to put together a list of everything that was released before 1972 and make sure that that isn't on your servers, because the safe harbour doesn't apply. Surely that can't be the logical implementation of this law. So initially the judges were like, that can't be right. Although, as you say, on appeal, they then sort of wavered and said, well, perhaps it is a good argument. But in the end, actually, that wasn't the case that saw the end of GrooveShark. So we never actually got resolution on that particular argument, because along the way, Universal found another technicality to exploit.
Yes, because in 2011, it launched a second lawsuit claiming that documents that had been handed over as part of the first lawsuit had uncovered evidence that employees at GrooveShark and its parent company, Escape Media, had uploaded infringing content themselves, as well as the firm's users. They reckon like over 100,000 unlicensed tracks, although that number was later reduced to 5,000, which is somewhat smaller.
But still, 5,000 recordings.
Still 5,000 more than zero.
That it was alleged that GrooveShark themselves had uploaded. And that was a really important point, because the safe harbour only applies if users are uploading the content into the system, not if employees at the instruction of the company are uploading it. And it was during the discovery process of the 1972 lawsuit that Universal got access to the documentation that they felt proved that that was what GrooveShark were doing. GrooveShark, perhaps predictably, denied that that was happening. There was then a massive spat between GrooveShark and the website Digital Music News, because it was in the Digital Music News, I think the comments section on the website.
It was one specific commenter who had claimed to be a employee of GrooveShark and detailed how they'd been told to upload illegal content to make sure there was stuff on the servers. And then, yeah, there was a whole side thing with GrooveShark suing Digital Music News, trying to force the website to hand over the identity of the commenter so that they could, I don't know, sue them for talking out of turn. Or at least say they're not actually an employee of GrooveShark.
Yeah, maybe get them in court and make them stand by their claims in the witness box. So yeah, we now had multiple lawsuits happening all over the place. For quite a long time throughout this entire process, GrooveShark remained pretty bullish And some internal documents that at one point came out showed that there was still hope amongst Grooveshark's founders and backers that throughout all of this, their user base continued to grow. Streaming was taking off. In Europe, Spotify and Deezer were really starting to gain traction. Grooveshark was sort of the service that had decent growth in the US. And so you really felt that the founders and the people running Grooveshark were still hoping that they would get to a point where they could go to the music industry and say, okay, you may not like how we got here. You may think that we've committed copyright infringement, but we've now got such a big audience. You need to come and license us. You need to come and work with us. You need to help us make this a legit service because you would be mad to lose all of these users.
Yeah, and one of the emails that was uncovered by Universal as they were going through all these documents that had been handed over by Grooveshark, there was a message from an investor who said, we bet the company on the fact that it's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is to ask for permission.
And all the other startups desperately trying to get their licensing deals in place to launch streaming services would probably be sympathetic to that because it's really expensive to launch a streaming service. And it was really hard to get those initial licensing deals in place. However, despite the bullishness amongst Team Grooveshark, it really did feel as these various lawsuits went through the motions and the years started to pass, that eventually you reached a point where the real sense from everyone you spoke to on the record industry side was, you got to a point where however good the Grooveshark proposition was, however right Grooveshark were to say, look, we've built this platform, we've got this audience, streaming's about to explode, you should help us make this work. It just got to the point where Universal Music just wanted to sue them out of business. And however good that offer may have been, it was like, we would much rather see you sued out of business and I suppose make an example of you rather than go into business and capitalise on the audience you have built.
Yeah, so the next stage was that Warner and Sony joined Universal's lawsuit. EMI withdrew its licensing agreement and then also separately from the others sued Grooveshark twice and ultimately became part of the main case when it was shut down and sold to the other majors.
And so all in all, things were not looking good for Grooveshark, and eventually in this one case the record industry, certainly on paper at least, won.
Yes, I mean, the cracks had begun to show by 2013. Sam Tarantino, the CEO, in an interview commented that they were having to downsize because of the cost of this litigation. He was now only paying himself $60,000 a year as a salary. That was how hard up the company was. But the company continued to operate and despite the ongoing disputes with major labels, managed to secure licenses with some indies and publishers and weirdly included EMI Music Publishing and Sony ATV. So while the major record companies were suing this streaming service out of business, on the publishing side, they were getting deals with their counterparts. So that was strange.
Along the way, they also started to dabble with other revenue streams. They talked about adding sort of like direct-to-fan type stuff into the business. At one point, they did, and I suppose this is when it really looked like they were probably in the last chapter, they then started talking about how hard it was to make streaming work, even without all of this litigation piling on.
Yes, I mean, it was particularly hard for them to make streaming work because along the way they had their apps removed from like Apple's App Store, Android stores, Chromecast app stores. His Facebook page was deleted. The term Grooveshark was blacklisted from Google's autocomplete suggestions on search.
All of that, of course, was because the record industries were putting pressure on Apple and Google, etc., to stop Grooveshark from reaching an audience.
Yes, but along the way, clearly, you know, the labels really put forward their argument in a way that all those companies, you know, Facebook and Google, don't always fall in line with the labels, but did in this case. But they carried on fighting. And I mean, only a few weeks before they eventually went offline, Grooveshark launched a new version of its website and it claimed to have improved discovery tools and addressed the industry's desire for more flexibility in controlling content, was how they described it. They pushed a new personalized radio service called Broadcast. It had launched a few months earlier and was licensed via Sound Exchange in the way that Pandora is. So that was kind of properly licensed. But the end was in sight.
Which brings us to 2015 and the announcement that in order to end all of these continuing to mount legal woes, Grooveshark had reached a settlement with the American record industry, which basically consisted of shutting down, deleting the servers, and then apologising in a really full-on way. Bearing in mind, as we say, throughout most of this, they've been quite cocky, they've been quite bullish, so that it seemed like the labels really wanted them to go above and beyond in apologising for all of their bad deeds.
Yeah, the final stumbling point was when a judge ruled that a jury would decide the damages that Universal should be awarded, and that would be a maximum of 150 $150,000 per infringement, as we've seen in numerous other copyright infringement cases. That meant Grooveshark was potentially facing being ordered to pay out $736 million, which is quite a lot of money. And so, yeah, Grooveshark at that point decided to agree a settlement. And it was a settlement that, well, obviously full terms are not disclosed, but as we understand it, there was no financial element to the settlement. They didn't have to hand over any money, but they did have to shut down the service. They handed over ownership of Grooveshark to the major labels, who have never relaunched it, surprisingly. But the most embarrassing bit was this grovelling apology they had to publish, because they'd been so cocky all throughout, and it was really very grovelling.
Yeah, so we started out nearly 10 years ago, said the founders of Grooveshark on the day they closed, with the goal of helping fans share and discover music. But despite the best of intentions, we made very serious mistakes. Keywords there. We failed to secure licenses from rights holders for the vast amount of music on our service. That was wrong. We apologise. Without reservation.
Concluding their humiliation, given how many times they'd gone on about how they were an artist-friendly platform, they said, if you love music and respect the artists, songwriters and everyone else who makes great music possible, use a licensed service that compensates artists and other rights holders.
And by this point, there were others to choose from.
Yes.
Even in the US.
They listed them all under their apology.
So streaming had really started to gain momentum by the point that Grooveshark went out of business. Although I have always thought that part of this deal was that Grooveshark had to delete their servers and all the music that had been uploaded over the years onto it, and they did that. But actually, what the record industry should have said to Grooveshark as part of that deal is, give us your servers. Because in the Grooveshark catalogue, there were tracks that Grooveshark users had digitised and uploaded that no label has ever got round to digitising. And you mentioned earlier how their catalogue was bigger than Spotify's catalogue and Deezer's catalogue and so on. So actually, they should have used the Grooveshark users as a free digitisation service and looked for all the recordings that were sitting on the Grooveshark platform that aren't on the other platform, work out which labels own them and get them onto the legit services. So I still think that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. But they didn't do that. And I mean, as you said, the real aim of Universal as things went along seemed to be that they didn't really care. I mean, they did the same thing with LimeWire. They didn't really care whether it became a legit service, whether it launched tools that were really useful for the music industry. They just wanted it shut down no matter what. And they assumed that they would be able to continue paying lawyers longer than Grooveshark would. And they were correct about that. And so ultimately, Grooveshark disappeared. Well, it didn't entirely disappear, because clones popped up. And actually, there are clones still in existence today if you want to go and look for them, which you shouldn't, because it'd be very bad if you did that. And 2 weeks before Grooveshark went offline, the IFPI moved Safe Harbors to the top of its piracy action list, which kicked off the endless lobbying for changes in the law, both in the US and Europe, which we have been reporting on ever since, although largely it has been less fun than when we were reporting on Grooveshark.
Yes, one of the early and more amusing and entertaining Safe Harbor stories and pre-1972 technicality stories that we reported on. It all seems like such happy days now, doesn't it? So let's all spend a few moments remembering the fun, entertaining, evil copyright infringing streaming service that was Grooveshark.
So that's it for this special edition of Setlist. If you have any questions or comments, let us know via email, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk, or on social media. We're Setlist Pod in most places. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, sitting in for Matt this week, who is swanned off to Spain. That is Richard Power. The show's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.